Very often in our prayers, we pray that God will help us to forget the things surrounding us, the things of this world and of this life, to center our hearts on heavenly, eternal things. And I feel that if we have participated in this service this morning to this point, in spirit and understanding, that surely this has to some degree at least been achieved. Our songs have been centered in heaven. We sang first of the King, all glorious above. And then we sang of that great host of heaven on Zion's glorious summit, with whom we seek to join our voices. We sang of that love that offers to us eternal life. Our participation in the Lord's Supper was to remember Him until He comes again. And then we praise the God of our salvation, whom hosts on high constantly worship and whose praise they proclaim.
Heaven, after all, is what it's all about. And the kingdom that we read about in the Bible is a kingdom of heaven. Everything is centered in God. And the heavenly hosts proclaim the righteousness of God. Heaven is a place of absolute perfection, a place of purity, a place of respect for God. It is a place of holiness, separation from all evil. It is a place of immortality, in contrast with mortality and with time. But we're back here on this earth. We're in the world, a world that is filled with sin in contrast with the purity and holiness of heaven. A world where all things are transient and passing in contrast with the eternity of heaven. We're in a world that is finite, where all power that is possessed by men, even the most powerful men, is limited. Unlimited power is beyond us. Time itself is a restraint upon us in contrast with the eternity of heaven. But there is on the earth the kingdom, and we have to accommodate ourselves to spatial representation, for the kingdom is in all the earth, but I'm doing it that way to remind us that the kingdom of the kingdom of heaven is surrounded by the kingdom of Satan. And I think we easily tend to think of the kingdom as being established on the day of Pentecost and really pertaining to this world. It's the church, we say. And that by God's grace, this kingdom that exists here upon earth is going to be more or less extended into eternity. But that's just not the way it is. And I don't think I will ever forget the time when I discovered, and I can't even remember who brought it to my attention, I discovered the fact that it's not a matter of the kingdom that exists here upon the earth being extended into eternity. But rather it is the idea that the kingdom of heaven has been projected back into time, so that we living here in an alien world and in a strange environment are yet permitted to be citizens of the kingdom of heaven. Really, this is the natural location of the kingdom. This is where it is due to be. It is by nature eternal. And it is only by the grace of God and the accommodation that has been made possible by the death of Christ that we living here in an alien society, alien culture, an alien relationship, can be citizens of heaven. We sometimes wonder what it would be like if a spaceship we'd have to say something beside Mars now, I guess, from Jupiter or Neptune or some other place out beyond us where we have not explored.
If some spaceship should come from some distant planet and land upon Earth, and the inhabitants of that spaceship should come out of that, or that planet should come out of that spaceship and live here among us, what would they be like? How would they conduct themselves? Well, we'd try to kill them before they had a chance to show us, but what would they be like? How would they live? What would be their habits? What would be their nature? Of course, that's science fiction. That's fantasy. But they would be no different from what's around them than the citizens of the kingdom of heaven dwelling among the citizens of the kingdom of Satan. I'm confident of that. Now, they might be different in appearance or in some ways in which the citizens of the kingdom of heaven are not different. But they would be no more different taking everything as a whole. And I wonder if we have ever understood that. I wonder if we have ever understood that when we are born of water and of the Spirit, we become citizens of another kingdom. Not just another kingdom that exists in another part of the world, but of a kingdom that pertains to another world. I wonder if we realize really that we're just not like the world around us. This 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters of Matthew, this Sermon on the Mount, I believe we could study it not for one quarter, but I know we can study it for a lifetime and never fully comprehend all that is there by way of description. And in the close of this 5th chapter, Jesus is saying that we must be perfect as the Father in heaven is perfect. This is the goal that we're seeking to achieve, and this is what we're working toward, to become on earth perfect as the Heavenly Father is perfect. To have these heavenly qualities and characteristics even when we live here in an alien world. Surely if we ever understood that, we would cease to make some of the arguments that we make. Would cease to justify ourselves by some of the rationalization that we use to justify ourselves. Jesus begins that Sermon on the Mount by thumbnail description of this citizen of the kingdom of heaven. He's poor in spirit. He is tender-hearted. He is hungry and thirsting not after the food of this world, but after righteousness. He is merciful. He is pure in heart. He is persecuted. And two that I have intentionally skipped thus far, he is meek and he is a peacemaker. And as Jesus continues the sermon, I think he elaborates on several of these. We studied in the Bible class that there is to be no hatred in the heart. That would be an elaboration of being a peacemaker. We learned that there is to be no lust in the heart. That would certainly be an elaboration of purity of heart. We studied this morning about no swearing, no light use of the name of God, but absolute integrity. Fulfilling our promises and respecting the high and holy name of God. And in verse 38, he begins an elaboration of this quality of meekness, I think. You heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, if I may add this thought as a citizen of the kingdom of heaven, that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. The Jews had been a part of a kingdom that was ruled from heaven, and yet it was not a heavenly kingdom. It was, to some degree at least, an earthly kingdom, existing side by side with earthly kingdoms. The law of Moses that was given was a civil law, as well as it was a law governing the man's personal relationship with God. And what Jesus here quotes is quoted literally from the law of Moses. If you turn back to Leviticus, the 24th chapter, verses 19 and 20, you'll find these words. If a man calls a blemish in his neighbor, as he hath done, so shall it be done to him. Breach for breach, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As he hath called a blemish in a man, so shall it be done unto him again. I think that we should understand that as we study this, we are studying laws that are judicial in nature. I remind you again that this law was the civil law, and it was actually instructing judges as to how they were to carry out their civil responsibility. This was an index to them as to what kind of punishment should be meted out to a man who had caused the loss of an eye in his neighbor intentionally and with premeditation, or had caused the loss of a tooth in his neighbor intentionally and with premeditation. The fact that this is judicial is made very clear in Deuteronomy, the 19th chapter. Beginning with verse 15, we read these words from the law. One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin, and any sin that he sinneth. At the mouth of two or three witnesses, or at the mouth of three witnesses, shall the matter be established. If a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the law, before the priests and the judges which shall be in those days. And the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witness be a false witness and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall he do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shalt thou put the evil away from thee. And those that remain shall hear and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you, and thine eye shall not pity, but life shall go for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Now you can see the context there is requiring a judicial execution of these requirements. And if I was trying to put out your eye and pray, and if this fact is evident beyond doubt to the judge, then they should take my eye. Not in some kind of heated fight, but in a calm execution of the law that God had given. That kind of an execution of law in our time would have a considerable effect, I'm sure, upon the practices of many people. If I intentionally take the eye of another man, then my eye will be taken. If I cause the loss of a tooth, then my tooth will be taken. If I take his life, my life will be taken. I'll be careful how I treat my neighbor. But the Jews had apparently gone to this and had begun to take this as an excuse for immediate retaliation. If he takes my eye, I'll take his eye. If he takes my tooth, immediately I'll take his tooth. If he tells an eye on me, I'll tell an eye on him. If he cheats me out of 5 denarii, I'll cheat him out of 10. I'll get him back immediately, instantly. The law even forbade that. Look back at Leviticus 19 again, and this time we look at verse 18. And see what the writer says. Leviticus 19:18, thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people. For thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord. Then turning over to Proverbs, the 20th chapter, and verse 22, the wise man Solomon, in giving rules for daily conduct, says, "Say not thou, I will recompense evil, but wait on the Lord, and He will save thee." Don't think you can take the law into your own hand. Wait on the Lord. Let Him save you. You are not to try to take that eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. If that's done, let the government do it. And this is one of the ways in which God does what He has promised to do. These Jews then, in taking this law that God had intended for judicial execution, making it a matter of private affair, were misusing the law of God. For Jesus gives a rule by which His people will be governed that is clearly personal in its nature. And I want us to read again these words of Jesus, for I feel that they need to be thought on constantly. Matthew 5:38, "Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever will smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. Whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow thee, turn not thou away." Jesus not only makes the statement, "Resist not him that is evil," but He gives three characteristic conditions or circumstances in which this is to be applied. In the first place, He speaks in terms of physical violence. If a man strikes thee on one cheek, turn to him the other also. The striking on the cheek, the slap of the cheek, is painful. Not only is it painful, but it is insulting. And because it is so painful and so insulting, it makes this a perfect test of our willingness to accept God's instructions along this line. Jesus said, if he slaps you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. I have seldom expressed these words of Jesus, suggested these words of Jesus, but someone does not say, "Do you think he's talking literally?" Even if Jesus is talking figuratively, it would surely include this. A principle that would allow me to be painfully hurt and insulted, and would require me that under those circumstances I should not retaliate, would require that if I were literally slapped on the cheek, painfully and insulting, I would not retaliate. Now someone will say, "That's unreasonable." Yes, from a human point of view. And it's difficult. You just can't do that. From a human point of view, yes. I would have to agree that's so. But that's what makes this a test of our faith. It was difficult for Abraham to offer his son Isaac on an altar. More difficult, I suppose, than for me to turn the other cheek. But God expected him to do it. And just as sure as a man slapped me on one cheek, and instead of turning to him the other, I slap him on the cheek, we've got a good fight going. And I do not believe that God intends for Christians to be embroiled in a fight. Regardless of how difficult the thing may seem, how unreasonable it may appear, I have known Christians myself who practice this, were not simply slapped on the cheek, but pummeled with a fist, who did not respond and did not retaliate. They didn't come out too well physically. I don't know, they may have come out as well as if they had retaliated. I don't know what kind of pugilist they might have been. They didn't come out too well physically. But when it was known that a Christian had responded in that manner, his stock as a Christian rose in the mind of everybody who heard about it. I'm thinking of a gospel preacher who was attacked physically. And my first question was, did he fight back? And when I heard that he didn't fight back, got a black eye,
some bruises, was hurt. I admired him a great deal more. And they would have said, well, sure he did. You should have seen the mangled mess they carried out of the man that attacked him. Is that any great achievement? Is that something that Christians admire, a man who's physically strong and really can use his fists? Huh. The man who has self-control and can allow himself to be hurt rather than to hurt, I say, is the stronger man. The one that can mangle his opponent. But Jesus not only speaks in terms of physical violence, he speaks also in terms of judicial injustice. Here's a man that says, I'm going to take you to court. And he's going to take me to court and he's going to take away my coat. Now, it wouldn't be right. Even under the law, it was not legal for a man to take away the coat of another man. But suppose I see that he's going to take me to law and going to take away my coat. I know he would be doing me wrong. But better give up my coat. This is a little thing, and I think that's to be taken into consideration. It's a relatively small thing. It would be better for me to let him have my coat and throw him a cloak also, the larger garment that might cover him. Throw that in. But it would be to go through a long legal suit involving a long court action. I'd probably come out better economically. If I took off from work 2 or 3 days and go down there and argue with him about that coat, I'd be a whole lot better off just let him have it. And go on about my business and get my work done and make my salary and not have to be bothered with it. Not only that, but I'm going to be better off spiritually. If I have to go down there and go through 2 or 3 days of legal argumentation, charges and countercharges about that coat, it's going to stir up my anger against him. I'm going to be filled with wrath toward him. The idea of him trying to do this to me, he just has no right to do this. Before long, I'm filled with bitterness, and I'm filled with hatred, and I'm filled with malice, and there's the inclination to want to get even with him. Oh, that's a greater cost to pay than 2 or 3 days' wages. Hatred is a terrible thing to have in our heart. Think of what we spend to get rid of rats in a house. Rats shows up. Think of what we spend to get rid of little roaches. I've heard they don't even carry disease. I don't want to find out. They like roaches. They like rats. We spend large amounts of money to get rid of rats and roaches and then harbor hatred in our own hearts. Oh, better just say, oh, friend, go and take my coat. I'll give you a cloak, too. Let's just be done with it. Forget about it. Somebody says, that's the principle that... It is the principle of the thing. That's exactly right. It is the principle of the thing. And the principle of the thing is, blessed are the meek. Blessed are the peacemakers. Not blessed are those that always stand up for their rights. In fact, if you were going to give a good definition of meekness, the easiest way to do it would be to take the negative. He's not the fellow that's running around with a chip on his shoulder, daring anybody to knock it off. Or the kind of fellow that's got his cotton. There's the line drawn here, now my rights are here, and as long as you stay on that side of the line, you'll be all right, but if you put one toe over the line, buddy, you've had it. Now, the opposite of that, meekness. And Jesus said, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. But he goes on. He goes on now to talk about government oppression. And I guess we'd have to have just a little history lesson and try to transport ourselves into another situation to understand this one. In those days, Israel was under an occupation army. Maybe we could imagine ourselves having been in Germany or Japan right after the war with an occupation army. That Roman occupation army wasn't too considerate of those who were under their control.
I don't suppose opposition armies usually are. But they had a rule whereby if a Roman centurion had a load to carry, or even a soldier of very private and low status, and he needed to go someplace in a country with which he was not familiar, he could take a fellow over here that was plowing his farm, say, "Come here." And the man comes and he says, "Put that load on your back. Take me a mile down the road. Where are you going?" "I'm headed for Jericho. Take my load. Lead me to Jericho." "How far?" "A mile." "Can't you see I'm plowing over here? I've got the sun's about to go down. I've got to get to Jericho. Get you plowing. Take my load a mile." "Or maybe I'm looking for a man's house in here in this city of Jerusalem. Do you know where it is?" "Yes, I know where it is, but I've got my shop to keep here." "I don't care about your shop. I've got to find that man. Drop what you're doing, take my load, show me where it is." "Well, it's a mile over there. I'll be going through the streets of Jerusalem for an hour. What about my shop? Forget your shop. I've got to go. You take me." That would be hard enough for a friend. Harder still for the soldier of our own government. Think about having to carry the load of a Roman soldier through the streets of Jerusalem and leave my shop. He has no right to demand that on me. Logically, he has no right to demand that of you. But Jesus says if he forces you to go 1 mile, instead of doing so with bitterness and doing so with malice and trying to do everything you can to get out of it and avoid it, Jesus says just go to it. Just go with him too. Do so, obviously, cheerfully, willingly, without bitterness, without hatred, without trying to get at him. You know, that kind of a rule sounds the death knell to the doctrine of civil disobedience. I'm not saying it makes it wrong for us to take advantage of the provisions of the law. Not at all. But when the law clearly makes a demand, and it's a demand that I can fulfill without violating the law of God, then I do it. But it's unreasonable. It doesn't matter how unreasonable it is, you do it. Why? The king said it. What king? My king. The king of heaven. He goes on even into an economic policy. Economic policy. A man comes and wants to borrow. If a man comes and wants a gift, you don't turn him away. Now, this is easily misunderstood because of the conditions in our time, which are different from the conditions in those times. You know, in our times, everybody wanted to borrow something. In those times, borrowing and lending were very carefully regulated by the law. And the man was only to come borrowing when he was absolutely reduced to necessity, when he had to borrow in order to live. Now, in these times, I think we need to be careful lest in lending to every man that comes our way, we violate some other passage. One of the things that we must do in the Scriptures, of course, is to interpret one passage in the light of another passage. 2 Thessalonians 3:10 says, "If a man will not work, neither shall he eat." And if a man is lying around doing nothing, won't work, just shifting around, borrowing and asking of people, and we just bail it out as he comes asking for it, in our effort to fulfill the instructions of Jesus, which were given in another time and another circumstance, we'll violate the instructions of Paul, which actually applied to the Gentiles, whose lifestyle was more like ours. In 1 Timothy 5:22, Paul said, "Lay hands hastily or suddenly on no man, neither be partakers of other men's sins." If I just dole out money to everybody that comes along wanting something, first thing I know, I'll be partaking of his sins. Well, many times the thing that is desired is not money for food, not for clothing, not for shelter,
but for some kind of a project that a man would be better off with not to pursue. I need to take this in the light. But if a man comes to me and by me, and I have something that I can share with him, then what Jesus is saying is, by all means, to lend to him. Don't turn him away. Give to him. Follow after peace. I believe that these teachings of Jesus are to be taken at face value, honestly. I don't see any way to tone them down. When Jesus says that if a man slaps you on one cheek, you turn to him the other also, I don't know any reason to soften that. It's not limited to that. If a man tells a lie about me, and I say, well, he didn't slap me on the cheek, he just told a lie about me, I'll tell one on him. No. There is a principle that applies in all areas, and it really illustrates what Jesus has said, resist not him that is evil. When a man wrongs you, you don't wrong him back. That's the point. Or if a man is suing me at the law and trying to take something that I know he doesn't have any right to, let's make peace with him. Even if it means that I have some laws. And I think this could be carried to extremes. We are talking in terms of a coat, not a farm. And I think that needs to be taken into consideration. We can defend ourselves in the law when we're unjustly taken to law. That's made clear in the scriptures by Paul's very actions. We can defend ourselves. But the point is, over matters of no consequence, we're to, by all means, be peace-loving and peaceful and contribute to peace. If the government requires something of us that's not reasonable, we don't lead a protest march in the civil disobedience movement, but we simply submit. That's the nature of citizens of the kingdom of heaven. But again, we're faced with the statement, that's unreasonable. That's what makes it a test of faith. When Jesus asks of us anything that is altogether reasonable, then it takes no faith to perform it. It takes no faith to comply with it. If the Lord had told the people of Jericho to build a battering ram and batter down the walls of Jericho, it wouldn't have taken any faith to comply with those instructions. That was the obvious way to go. But when God said, you march around the wall 7 times, it took some faith to do that because that wasn't reasonable. The Lord asks of us things that are not reasonable to men as a test of our faith. Someone says, that's contrary to human nature. Of course it's contrary to human nature. Who's denied? Who's questioned that? It's a part of that divine nature which we become partakers when we're born into another kingdom by the new birth. Or when we crucify this old man, this carnal man, and are buried in baptism and raised to a new life in which Christ lives within us and Christ rules and governs us. Paul said, I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I that live, but Christ liveth in me. Suppose a man slapped me on one cheek, and I knock him flat at his back, and I tell you what I did, boy, I laid him out. You say, why did you do that? And I say, it's no longer I that live, but Christ liveth in me. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? I'm a new man. I'm a different man. Christ is in me. And I just do not respond as others respond. Someone says, but that's unjust. Evildoers deserve to be punished. Of course they do. But have you been punished for every wrong you've ever done? Have I? I've gotten by. And you've gotten by on occasion with mischief. When men take vengeance, is it just? If he slaps me on one cheek and I break his leg, is that a just recompense? Is that a reasonable punishment for a slap on the cheek? Man is really not very well in position to give just punishment. And if I break his leg for a slap on the cheek, that's not an eye and an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth even. That's going beyond that. That's requiring more of it. And that's the way we perform. If you owe me and I decide I'm going to pay you for it, I seldom can pay you exactly what you did to me. If we get in a fight, well then I may either underdo it and not give you all you deserve because I'm not able to. Or if I'm bigger and stronger than you are, I may give you more than you deserve because I'm big and able to do it. Seldom will it come out with exactly the kind of punishment that you deserve. The whole point is that vengeance does not belong to man. This is clearly stated not only in the teaching of Jesus, but in the teaching of the Apostle Paul in the 12th chapter of Romans, beginning with verse 19. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, neither give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. This morning in our study, in our class, we dealt with the preceding portion of the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus said, swear not at all. We had some difficulty with these instructions of Jesus, knowing just how to apply them, because when we went on, it appeared that Jesus took an oath judicially. And it appeared that Paul called heaven to witness at least to the truthfulness of what he was saying. And in this teaching, if a man smites you on one cheek, turn to him the other. If a man takes you to law and takes your cloak, give him your cloak also to avoid trouble. And if a man makes you go a mile, go with him too to avoid trouble. Maybe if we go on over in the scriptures, we'll find something to modify that. Let's see about Jesus. What did Jesus do? How did Jesus respond? Well, when we find him on the cross, when they were nailing his hands and his feet to the cross, he assures us that he could call down legions of angels to defend him. But what did he do? He said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And when the soldiers came to take him, Peter was going to punish them. He didn't want to deal with this situation, and he takes up his sword and cuts off the ear of the servant of the high priest. Jesus says, Peter, put up your sword. For they that take the sword shall perish by the sword. And he healed the ear of the servant of the high priest. And then we come over to the book of Acts and to chapter 6. And we read of a disciple of Jesus. It might be easy for us to say, well, Jesus might be able to do that, but surely no man could do it. But here's this disciple of Jesus, as he's in controversy, and then in the 7th chapter he makes a speech before a court, and at the end of that speech, well, he's not even at the end of it, before he can finish it, they're so angry with him, they begin to gnash on him with their teeth and to throw stones at him. And just as he's dying, he says, Father, lay not this sin to their charge. I would challenge you to find a single instance in the New Testament where a real disciple of Jesus, one of the apostles, or one of the disciples whose conduct is clearly approved in the Scripture, or one of them retaliated in a personal way against anyone who wronged him. Paul said in the first chapter of Philippians, while he was in prison, there were those out there preaching that they might stir up problems for him and his bonds. And Paul said, I rejoice that Christ is preached. I don't have any bitterness to them. I don't have any desire to retaliate. I don't desire to hurt them. Whenever a Christian is harmed or hurt, as we will be, inevitably, and we sit down and start trying to figure out how to get even, or how we are going to right the wrong that's been done us. How we are going to take that tooth, for the tooth he knocked out of my mouth, or that eye that he's blackened in my face. How I'm going to see to it that he squirms for all the squirming he's caused me to do, and hurts for all the hurting he's inflicted in me. Then we're acting like the people of the world and not as citizens of the kingdom of heaven. We missed it. We missed it all the way. I see the sign every now and then. There's a room for a few good men in the, what is it, the Marine Corps or the Merchant Marine or somewhat. Room for a few good men. And there's room for a few good men in the kingdom of heaven. Oh, you say, doesn't the Bible say that all are called? Yes, many are called. But few are chosen. And there are very few that are chosen, because there are very few that are willing to crucify the old self and to be made new. There are very few that are willing to renounce their old citizenship in order to be citizens of the kingdom of heaven. There are very few that are willing to renounce this carnal nature that they may become partakers of the divine nature. But oh, what a marvelous life they live. They live a better life in this world. They get along better. They enjoy the peace that they make, even if it be by concession, by giving in sometimes. And they most certainly live a happier life in anticipation of that time when they'll be transferred home. You ever see somebody that was away from home working, and he's just living for a transfer home? And really, the Christian who is here on the earth is away from home working. He's in a foreign country. He's a stranger. He's a pilgrim. And he just can't wait for his transfer home. And when he gets home, all of his loyalty to the king and all of the sacrifices and all of the hardships will be well worth it. Are you one of those few good men or few good women who's willing to crucify the flesh with the lusts and passions thereof, to be born again of water and the Spirit, to be buried with Christ in baptism and raised to walk a new life, a life of absolute submission to Jesus, a citizen of the kingdom of heaven, no longer ruled and governed by the motives, the passions, the customs, the influences of the world around you. If you don't like that, then you're called this morning by the Lord. If you'll accept that call, genuinely repent, be baptized into Christ, you'll be one of those chosen ones. You'll be citizens of another kingdom when you leave this place this morning. We hope there's someone here who'll respond as we stand and sing.